Indie Media is DIY News. It is about people reporting their own news directly, without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media. There are now almost 100 Indie Media websites or IMCs worldwide, providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns, and protests. The project started 3 years ago, covering the massive Seattle protests that shut down the World Trade Organization summit. Uncensored and unsponsored, indie media sites can be updated literally anytime, anywhere, and by anyone. The open-to-all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news. What you are about to hear are some highlights from those global websites and the UK's very own indie media site. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to this week's Indie Media Newswire show on Resonance 104.4 FM. We have a whole bunch of stories for you. We have the usual 15-minute outro, and today we've got a 20-minute piece on sustainable gardens. But first, well, everything that you hear will come from the Indie Media Newswires, whether it's the UK website or the global website or one of the 140 websites around the world. We're going to start off today with some stories from the east, from Russia.
Over in Russia, a new anti-militarism initiative has been launched by girls sick of seeing their menfolk called up by the meat machine that is the Russian army. 9th of May saw anti-draft happenings at romantic haunts in towns and cities throughout Russia. The girls started their campaign after one by one the guys were called up. They proclaim that humanity cannot exist without love and that the draft is an exercise in freakish cruelty and that it requires the surrender of independent thought and action by those taken. Conscription is due to be abolished in Russia by 2007, but, these girls ask, how many more boys will be killed in training and action before then? For more information, see russia.indiemedia.org, but it's in Russian.
And protest against the mixed oxide nuclear reprocessing plant in Tomsk, Serbia. Tomsk citizens refuse to allow their hometown to be turned into a nuclear washhouse for the world, say protesters. Plans for Russia to start importing foreign nuclear waste, weapons grade, and convert it at specially built plants, MOX plants. In spite of the region voting 90% against a referendum 3 years ago that broke all previous turnout records, pro-nuclear protesters were paid by Severinsk nuclear officials to attend in a delegation from the closed town that is home to the current nuclear facilities. Closed means passports are required for entry, and the town exists in a separate governmental authority from the surrounding Tomsk region. Governed directly from Moscow, the Ministry of Atomic Energy. The protesters were happy with their action, which attracted widespread media coverage and positive reactions from passers-by. If it's all so safe, one woman said, why do countries like France have to send it all the way to Siberia? The protesters gathered in the town's main square and streets for a creative protest and picket of the authorities involved. Organised say the support for the anti-nuclear campaign is increasing week on week. Follow this one, folks. It's an issue that will run and run.
On the banks of the river Neva, in the formerly uninhabitable swampland, Russia's enlightened capital, St. Petersburg, stands. For centuries, the home of radicals, anarchists and revolutionaries, it has maintained this radical tradition to the present day. Critical mass. 70 people turned out, braving the rain, and took to the streets on bicycles of all models and hues. Participants included sporty grandmas, informal youth, punks, anarchists, and keen cyclists, making this one of the most diverse critical masses the East has seen. So successful was the event that the 12th of June will see critical mass protests in towns and cities across the Russian Federation. Again, see russia.indiemedia.org for more information.
And now back to the UK, we've got a track which you may have heard, but you may not have. It's from Morrissey, who's not one of my favourites. I never was really into Daffodils, but I like the lyrics on this one.
America, your head's too big. Because America, your belly's too big. And I love you, I just wish you'd stay where you is. Oh, 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 in America, the land of the free, they said, and of opportunity in a just and a truthful way. But where the president is never black, female or gay, and until that day, you've got nothing to say to me to help me believe. Oh, 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 in America, it brought you the hamburger. Oh, well, America, you know where you can shove your hamburger. And don't you wonder why in Estonia they say, hey you, hey you, big fat pig, you fat pig, fat pig, stinky blue eyes.
Tuesday, 11th of May, a greenwash business conference took place in North London under the name of What's the Point of Corporate Responsibility, organised by Ethical Corporation magazine. Participating companies included the likes of Shell, BP, Gap, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Levi and Marks and Spencers, and seminars included discussion topics such as why should chief executives take corporate responsibility seriously, is corporate responsibility simply another management fad, and how smart companies are using CR for commercial objectives. In the late afternoon, around 60 demonstrators congregated outside the hotel where the conference was taking place and engaged in a festive protest while refusing to accept the absurd proposition that corporations actually want to be held accountable. The picket was called under the name of Corporate Responsibility, You're Having a Laugh. The protesters included a samba band, activists of the Columbia Solidarity Campaign and London Rising Tide. Comedian Mark Thomas managed to avoid the £295 registration fee and blag his way into one of the conference seminars, where he pressed the panel with questions from the floor, such as it's inevitable that a corporation working within the free market is driven to increase profits and minimise costs, which results in human rights abuses and lack of trade union recognition, surely the rhetoric of claiming to adhere to human rights and environmental standards is actually just window dressing and greenwashing. While a McDonald's employee in the panel answered with the dubious claim that shareholders do indeed take account of human rights as much as they do profit margins, his co-panelist, a litigation lawyer, conceded that this was only partly true. Mark also corrected one of the panellists who stated in defence of Coca-Cola that the Colombian company which owns and operates the infamous bottling plant, which is currently being sued by representatives of trade unionists murdered there by parliamentaries, was independent and not owned by Coca-Cola. However, as Mark pointed out, Coca-Cola in fact owns 46% of the company. The legal action in the US is being conducted under the Alien Tort Claims Act, which is an old piece of legislation recently rediscovered and used in several similar high-profile lawsuits. Outside, someone explained how Coca-Cola had contributed to the terror in Colombia as well as stealing and polluting vast quantities of water in India. BP has forced thousands of people off their own land in Colombia to make way for a pipeline and also refuses to let its workers there organise into unions. Between speeches and subvertising chants, for example, baby cap, if they're old enough to wear them, they're old enough to make them, the samba band kept everyone's spirits high while suited corporate pigs went around telling people to get a job. When asked what the atmosphere was like inside the hotel, Mark Thomas gleefully revealed, as soon as they heard the drummers start, the shiver of fear went through the audience. Let's hope they hold on to that feeling.
Good. And now something a bit lighter, but involving music too. It's May, the sun's out. It seems like summer's here and the free party season is kicking off. The first of two Mystic May moot parties was held last weekend, with several sound systems kicking throughout the night, and the party seemed to be getting light attention and even cooperation from the police. However, later in the morning, a small number of police turned up in full riot gear, saying they would seize the generators, and a standoff ensued. Tensions rose, and several people were battened by police after a girl spat at one officer and a couple of beer cans were thrown. But the majority of the partygoers, however, stuck together and calmly held their ground. Also, recently, the first attempt this year at holding a big UK Technoval, that's a free techno festival to you and me, was nipped in the bud by the authorities and police, who managed to close down two sites where people had tried to hold the festival. In the end, a smaller event went ahead, and what was meant to be on the third day of the festival. Excuse me. However, lots of smaller outdoor parties have gone ahead successfully and unchallenged. Recently, and with the sun beaming down for the last few days, a little birdie tells us that there's something big afoot for the May bank holiday weekend at the end of the month. For info on festivals and free parties, check out www.technival.co.uk. That's TEKNIVAL.co.uk. And also at the end of the month, Kingston Green Fair, a family-friendly day of ecological awareness with bands, stalls, workshops, dance and more, and it's entirely powered by people, the sun and wind energy. It's on from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Canterbury Gardens, Kingston upon Thames. See kingstongreenfair.org.uk. And now we have a piece about sustainability from one of our other presenters, so you might recognise some voices in there.
Don't forget your mittens. get to town from here. And he said, we'll just take a right where they're going to build that new shopping mall. Go straight past where they're going to put in the freeway. And take a left at what's going to be the new sports center. And keep going till you hit the place where they're thinking of building that drive-in bank. You can't miss it. And I said,
I'm here with Arish.
This must be.
And Arish spends a great deal of time trying to stop the authorities in New York and the South Bronx bulldozing community gardens. And community gardens in New York are not like community gardens here. How are community gardens seen in New York?
It depends who sees them. A lot of the people in New York City themselves value them deeply. And that's been one of the big boons in keeping those community gardens. However, as we know, New York City and many of the big cities have an enormous amount of money to be made out of real estate. Some people say that is like the gold or the oil of New York City, so that a small two-bedroom apartment can go for $2,000 in the more gentrified neighborhoods of New York City, which is about £1,500.
What is that, a week?
Month. Which is quite a lot, especially if, you know, you can build a six-floor apartment with each one of those going for that much. You can make millions over the years. It's happening actually almost in any city that I keep going to across the United States and even outside of it. A lot of it, I can explain a little bit, was sort of thought of and planned in this spatial deconcentration plan. It's almost like an army term. In the early 30s and 40s, when people started seeing this trend of low-income African-American Latino population starting to take over the cities, inner cities, and the, you know, the white flight going outside. And so then there was political and economical changes coming to those neighborhoods. And they would elect, of course, people of their own kind. And so the white, rich, upper class, power controls, they said, this cannot go on. And so the plan kicked in a way where the inner cities, especially areas which were the danger areas, they specifically de-empowered. So the fire houses, the amenities like the garbage pickup, all of these things were removed. Even red zoning, which is when you loan to buildings so they can fix themselves up or be at low income, those were also all taken out.
But so don't people have to pay some kind of, like here for example, people that are working pay council tax to the local municipal,
yes,
that's responsible for the area. Were not these people paying some kind of tax, which meant that their rubbish should be picked up?
Now, these are, you know, as they said, with these, the economical depression times, like in the 60s and 70s and certain times, where they said, there's no money for anybody. I know everyone's paying taxes, but we have to cut back. And the cutbacks, however, were very unequal, where the rich neighborhood ended up still getting all of those things, while the poorer ones, having less power, having less oomph, ended up getting a majority of these cuts. And sure enough, people did get up, they did fight for it, but however, it was still saying, well, we don't have any money. And so by doing this, a lot of the areas ended up having very greedy landlords burning down their buildings rather than keeping it, since A, they couldn't afford it either. They burnt it for insurance purposes, and a lot of the areas ended up being gutted out, like up to two-thirds of South Bronx, where we're doing a lot of our community garden projects, were empty, just like totally torn out, and then they'll have broken buildings. People said it looked like World War II Germany or England or places where it was totally destroyed.
There was blind eyes turning to landlords destroying communities, and
right,
the blind eyes were turned in a completely racist way because these people are just Puerto Ricans,
yeah,
and we don't want them to build strong communities in the city. Yeah. That was the agenda.
That was the agenda. And to really, like, destroy those communities, both African-American and Latinos, ended up having a lot of these torn down buildings and nothing. And people would come bring their own trash and dump it in these vacant, broken down spaces. So the communities themselves said, well, fine, no one's doing it. We're going to do it for ourselves. So they took their own block neighborhoods and then started cleaning up these vacant lands, which is full of like tons and tons of trash, and moving it themselves to another location, and then starting to plant seeds, plant trees, plant out of their own pocket, out of their own sweat, out of their own love for the land. A lot of Puerto Ricans just love planting, and they come from backgrounds of that. And then African American folks, especially from the South, they love to like the peanuts in the ground and all sorts of different vegetables, from okra to just like wonderful eggplants and bell peppers, etc., even grapes, which they make wine out of. So they started planting all this, and of course the earth responded by giving back, and the trees started growing, and a lot of the land has brooks and underground streams, so even willow trees were really just bounced out of it. And people would take the bricks from the old buildings and then start putting the beds in there.
So the things that were left to destroy their community, they actually used to try and pull mm-hmm. their community together.
Yep. In most creative ways and most beautiful ways, where then their children who used to play on the rubble heaps are now playing in the community gardens, and they can themselves see from the building or the project which is next to it that right down there, and making sure their kids are good. And then of course, they would put playgrounds in it. They would put different types of foods that would then also give back. And they could save many thousands of dollars each year. Now, these neighborhoods also have the least amount of green space, like parks, etc., where a well-off neighborhood would have 3 acres per 1,000 people
of
green space, while that neighborhood in the South Bronx with the most intense amount of project would have about a quarter of an acre.
And by project, you mean like social housing, don't you?
Social housing. It's one of the poorest districts in the United States. It's about like a yearly income of the folks that's below £7,000. Some of them, of course, are homeless and have squatted in some of the broken-down houses. So again, there's this sense of poverty. And then on top of that, just to make it worse, there's also the highest pollution and environmental racism, in a way, where incinerators, garbage sites, parking for buses all over the city are all been, even power stations where they burn oil and gas have all been like concentrated in that area, and the politicians have sort of hand in hand with the builders have just allowed, say, let's dump some more. Yeah, oh, well, no, we're not really for it. We'll do a study for it, etc., and see if it's right or wrong. And, of course, another power plant is put there. So people have been now mobilizing, fighting, getting together to start erasing and changing that perception and that action that's been dumped on them. And the community gardens have been one of those lungs of their communities to try to protect the kids from the asthma, the highest asthma rate in the United States, 14 times the national average. And every little kid's got these little pump asthma things, one out of three in schools, where they're always like, you know, trying to open up their lungs. So in the community gardens, we actually plant mullein and different types of plants to try to help with tea, to open these beautiful lungs up and find alternatives to these chemical pumps. And this has been an ongoing thing for the last 20 years. More gardens have been coming, more community gardens have been planting, and people have been working together to make sure that they do stay there. Now, in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been this shift. Communities have replenished themselves, opened it up, and healed themselves. There's now a sudden onslaught of developers with the help of the politicians, coming to build housing, not for the low-income or homeless, but mostly for luxury-type housing. And that has been the whole shift of moving the population that once was there, African-American, Latino, Puerto Rican, and low-income, out. And of course, where do the population end up? Jails. They end up going to double up, triple up in the same project, etc. So there's this whole crunching, pushing, and really deleting of a population that had been there fighting and surviving throughout all of this, the worst times of, you know, the city's history. So our job as Moore Gardens, which has been started about 5 years ago, when the highest peak of trying to put every single community garden in New York City. And by the way, South Bronx is one of the many places. We have Harlem, we have the Lower East Side of Manhattan, we have East New York, next to that is Brownsville. All over the different boroughs of New York City, there are pockets, and you can tell exactly where these pockets of community gardens are. It's where people who have had the least opportunity have created the most amount of community gardens. So we've been basically saying we want more gardens. We don't want just permanent every one of these gardens, but we need like 2 to 3 times these community gardens to start a sustainable New York City that can eventually stand on its own without having to bring too much food, at least not from like Australia with kiwis or God knows else, bananas from South America, but really food from the city, inner city itself, and then community farms, CSAs, which are community-supported agriculture around the city, so they can just feed itself and not have to really waste so much energy in, you know, flying in things.
I think I remember when I was in one of the community gardens in the South Bronx, I noticed a situation with the garden that actually was bulldozed, that the local Catholic church had bought the land for social housing, and the people who had the garden were saying, well, there's other land that they could have had for the same amount of money in this district just one block away. But why do they want this land? Why do they want our garden? And it seemed to me that there was a deliberate attempt to break the heart of the community.
And now they have, on that same site, on that community garden, a very low density, 2, 3, 4 units of housing, where it basically, you know, maybe 20 people can stay there, while before we had hundreds of people gardening. And it's surrounded by quite high-rise, projects, which really didn't need, like, a, I don't know, 0.001% more population density added to it. So it was very hurtful to that community. And now we have actually gone ahead and found other sites for those gardeners to go. It's not as close. They're not looking over their windows in there. And especially the elders who have a harder time traveling aren't able to get there. But we have found for most of the gardeners a new location. And it was basically South Bronx churches, which is not even a church group, but it's a conglomeration and goes to churches, gets money from them. And they're supposed to be an activist group that help build housing for the community, but also help the community for what they want, if it's housing, if it's green space. And the community really did want that green space, but they've become somewhat of a development agency as well. So just to survive developing, they're now become this sort of a short-sighted group where it's just wanting to build on anything with whatever cost, forgetting what the community's needs are. And of course, developers have become a little bit like the backbone of the politicians, with since it's such a high cost of becoming politicians in the United States, you need tons and tons of money for commercial advertising, etc., etc. So they're both dependent on each other,
So we need to, I think people need as communities to reclaim their politics.
Absolutely do.
So we have reclaimed the streets, perhaps we need reclaim our politics. And I know that you have a lot of young people come and work in your gardens doing interns.
Yep.
And I was just thinking maybe for listeners in London that might be interested in gardening and sustainability, it might be possible for them to get in touch with the More Gardens project and arrange an internship. There's no money in it, but I guess people that are really motivated will find a way. If they wanted to, well, if anyone wanted to get in touch with More Gardens, how would they do that?
Just a little background of people we would be interested in. Obviously, you have to be self-motivated. You need to want to really, really participate in a consensus of the community decision-making and be a hard worker. However, if you do make it to New York City, and we have internships with universities, with schools, with whatever group of people you're in, and you can do from arts, building murals, giant puppets, bike animal type things.
Bike animal type
things. Yes, it's like community garden. We take bikes and we convert them into, let's say, a dragonfly, where it's both sustainable, like the front of it is a shopping cart and the back of it's a mountain bike, and then it has wings that actually flaps as you pedal. So it becomes this amazing vision of what we want to create in our world. So that's the arts aspect of it. Of course, the gardening is very key, and figuring out how to put compost, rainwater recycling. So it goes all the way to the sciences, and just also organizing. We have a legal team that's also figuring out legal ways of making sure we have legislation that then creates more green spaces in the future. And of course, that leads to working with politicians and starting getting them and new politicians who have a long vision of seven generations, not, you know, their next election moment. So there's like a huge amount of things that we would love to work with the people in, and people have a great time. We've just almost finished a new tree sculpture, as we call it, or tree house, and that's really exciting for me, who I love that creative aspect of it. So please come, and the way to get in touch with us is in a couple of ways. One is to go to moregardens.org, which is moregardens.org, there will be a email and phone numbers, etc., that you can then get in touch with. In case you need a phone number, that's New York City, United States, 212-533-8019. And we'd love to host you. And if you're there, like, full-time, we could probably find you some either very cheap housing or almost free housing that would be available. And we get lots of organic foods donated for food and other types of projects. And we work with kids who come and eat and play. And so it's just a big celebration, which is what we want to create in all of our communities.
Thank you very much, Aresh.
And that was a report by Penny from New York Gardens, and hopefully we won't have the same kind of hassle with allotments and gardens in London, but you never know. Right, we're going to go mixed bag here. Casper's going to do international stories, I'm going to go do UK stories, and we're going to alternate. So the first one. Following well-publicised abuse of Iraqi prisoners by US and British troops and the deteriorating situation in Iraq, the Stop the War Coalition has called a demonstration in London this Saturday 22nd, assembling at 11 a.m. at Embankment. More details, see www.stopwar.org. And next week is an exhibition of artwork and pictures about Coca-Cola's involvement with the Nazi Party during the Second World War, put together by Mark Thomas and others. It's part of a global campaign against Coca-Cola, who stand accused, and indeed who are now in court, over their alleged links to paramilitaries in Colombia and the deaths of trade union workers and their families. The exhibition runs from the 24th to the 30th of May at the Nancy Victor Gallery, 36 Charlotte Street, W1. And then from the 10th of June to the 30th, it's on at the Foundry, which is 86 Great Eastern Street, EC2.
The Flotilla 2004 Voyage is embarking on a 4,000-kilometre trip to Nauru, the tiny 21-square-kilometre Pacific island nation, home to just 12,000 people, to draw attention to asylum seekers jailed in Australian-made detention centres. The nine activists, who will be sailing in two boats under the banner Flotillas of Hope, will go to Nauru with teddy bears and toys for the detained children and an electricity generator for a hospital on the island. They hope to give the asylum seekers hope, compassion and to highlight their plight. It will be interesting to see what lengths the Australian government will go to in order to prevent ordinary Australians highlighting the plight and the shame of asylum seekers being indefinitely detained on Nauru in Australian concentration camps, said a spokesperson. If they arrest us when we do land, we will have won, because they will have to explain why they are locking up Australian and British citizens in their jails. They will also have to explain why they won't let our lawyers on the island to protect our rights. The images and messages sent out will be reminiscent of Guantanamo Bay, in fact worse, because they won't allow legal representation to happen. If they stop us using Australian naval at the 12-mile international water zone, then the messages and images of the two little boats being hounded by the Navy will be overkill. This is particularly so with our teddy bear flags blowing in the wind. The voyage departed May the 15th from Sydney Harbour. The boats are being joined by other boats at Newcastle and Brisbane on the trip north before going to Nauru to arrive on June 20th, which is World Refugee Day.
At the start of next month, the G8 summit will be staged on Sea Island, a private luxury resort island 80 miles south of Savannah in the United States. The site was specifically chosen for the G8 because it is, quote, impossible for protesters to access. However, protesters in America have had other ideas, and a whole host of demonstrations and actions, as well as counter-conferences, are planned. And next week, we'll be bringing you more details on the developments for the Sea Island G8 protests. Now, many people will have heard of the anti-globalisation protests against the G8 in Genoa in 2001, but the story didn't start there. In 1990, the G7, as it was then, held a meeting in London. It passed by quietly, and there were no protests or exclusion zones. 8 years later in the UK, and Birmingham saw massive resistance to the G8 meeting that was taking place there, as 60,000 people converged on Birmingham, with tens of thousands surrounding the summit and forming a human chain, demanding an end to third world debt. At the same time, thousands occupied the centre of Birmingham in a huge Reclaim the Streets party. This was the second global street party, with actions and protests happening against the G8 in 25 cities around the world, with over 400 social movements taking coordinated action under the banner of People's Global Action, which is PGA. Next year, in 2005, the G8 returns to the UK. Since last year, people have been talking about how to act against the G8 when they come here in 2005. A new network of local groups and individuals has emerged called the Descent Network, and is planning a series of awareness-raising events through the year, as well as laying ground for plans for possible protests. Many NGO organisations are also mobilising on a level unseen for years, and with the UK government set to try and pitch its presidency of the G8 as a positive step towards reducing third world debt and around issues of development trade, they have plenty to organise around. For more details, see www.descent.org.uk and the Trade Justice Movement website www.tjm.org.uk.
Monsanto, the world's biggest producer of GM crops and the related herbicides, has backed out of GM wheat productions for economic reasons. Against consumer and farmers' wishes, there is no market for GM wheat in Europe. Foreign buyers started looking for alternative sources in Australia and Eastern Europe, and US and Canadian farmers were not prepared to take the chance of some short-term benefits, a lot of future problems, and the loss of a world market overnight. Earlier this year, Monsanto had already closed its grain research facilities in Europe. Two GM wheat field trials of Syngenta were destroyed in Germany. Over the last year in Europe, the big biotech companies have been dropping out of one GM project after another. Monsanto and Syngenta dropped GM sugar beet, while Bayer decided not to market GM maize in the UK, even though they had got permission, and Spain has withdrawn BT176 maize from the market, the only GM crop commercially grown in the EU. Whole regions have gone GM-free. Finally, this is reflecting back on shareholders' opinions and the US markets.
Here, action has been taken this month against two companies who offer to make their customers carbon neutral, whether that be at work or play. Future Forests and Climate Care claim that any process involving CO2 emissions can be neutralised by planting a certain amount of new trees in forests they manage. Both have had complaints made to the British Advertising Standards Authority over misleading adverts placed in the press. Heidi Brackman of Carbon Trade Watch: the idea that people can burn fossil fuels and then plant trees to clean up the carbon dioxide that results is simply wrong. This false solution will merely keep people digging up oil instead of trying to shift to clean energy. This false solution has proved popular. Predictably, Future Forests' corporate clients include BP and Sainsbury's. But their clientele also lists Coldplay, Atomic Kitten and Jamiroquai. Every part of the rock star lifestyle is catered for. Long-distance flights, CD production and touring emissions can be neutralised if you pay someone to plant some friendly pollution-eating trees in their forest.
In the Philippines, as the national elections turn out to be a tight race between administration and opposition candidates, some people already warn of an impending credibility crisis in the case of administration win. Moreover, the list of human rights violations against progressive candidates during the campaign period is long, and militant party list representatives might be barred from taking office at all. Election Day has had its controversies, with President Gloria Pagel Ario campaigning beyond the prescribed campaigning period, and numerous reports of deliberate violations of COMELEC rules, including missing names on the voters list and flying voters at the most commonly reported. Meanwhile, a look behind the scenes reveals why the election process is prone to cheating and must be computerised as soon as possible.
And before we run out of time, the public meeting on ID cards, covered in previous shows, is on this afternoon at the LSE. For more information about the ID card issues, see www.stand.org.uk and www.privacyinternational.org. Next week, there's a meeting entitled Anti-Terrorism Laws Then and Now. It's next Wednesday, the 26th, at 7 p.m. in the Grand Committee Rooms at the House of Commons, and is organised the campaign against criminalising communities. We've run out of time, and we just about used everything that we brought with us, which is a change, because usually we have loads of stories that we haven't done. This week's outro starts with some very loud audio from South Africa. Quickly, it's four communities in Western Cape and some anarchists held a lively march to Parliament last week to greet the new housing minister. With news of the housing crisis and to demand her immediate attention, residents are threatened with the eviction of 60,000 households. Some of the singing and dancing was recorded very briefly, so I've put it into the outro. We've also got a piece about Greenpeace campaign. Greenpeace are being done by the American government. The whole of Greenpeace USA are being done by them for their stand against ExxonMobil and Mobil. And some music to end the show with. So we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye. Hey, 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 hey
about the people. Doesn't care if you are talking about love, if you are talking about war, if you are talking about hungry. Most of the people here, I believe, and I want to hear if someone is against me, that they are here only to feel the music, the rhythm. Don't care about the lyrics. That's what I think.
You're right. Most people do not care about our lyrics, and they only care about the music, and that's why we play music. That's why we're not politicians.
Just think of the tremendous selection and savings you'll gain. Of course, the loss of freedom and democracy are tragedies, I know. But consider the entertainment value contained within. And to remind you, it is you, the people, who have mandated this course of our fate. So please come with me.
Protesters were removed from Exxon's Irving headquarters in handcuffs that day last May. They were prepared to pay the price of civil disobedience, normally fines or limited jail time for trespassing on private property. None of them had any idea that more than a year later, they would be facing charges by the Dallas County DA's office for felony riot. Greenpeace Texas coordinator John Hosovar explains.
And, of course, this was a nonviolent protest. Many of them were dressed in tiger costumes, and it was a very sort of tongue-in-cheek action. But apparently one of the tigers was tackled by one of ExxonMobil's security guards, and he is claiming to have injured his wrist in the process. And so I think what makes it a felony is the fact that he was over 55, I believe, is the age. So that makes it an automatic felony. Then they were able to extend those charges to everyone involved. So then we have 36 people facing felony riot charges for a nonviolent protest to hold a corporation accountable for really egregious behavior.
But Exxon didn't stop there. In addition to the 36 individuals, the company is also seeking criminal charges against Greenpeace USA as an organization, a move that is unprecedented in American jurisprudence. In a related civil lawsuit, Exxon won a nationwide restraining order against Greenpeace, which prevents its activists from setting foot on company property, including gas stations.
I understand that I broke the law and that I committed civil disobedience, but now I feel like they're essentially trying to take away my rights from even doing a legal protest of Exxon. And I have a problem with that because I have a problem with Exxon's policies on global warming.
Scott is one of the 36 arrested in Irving.
Definitely have to kind of keep these issues and keep raising awareness about these issues. I definitely think our action that we did last year got attention worldwide. It was ran a 24-hour top news story in Europe. It was top news story in Australia. It was top news story in Texas, right? We watched it from jail, actually. So,
was it worth it?
Oh, definitely. It's very much an important thing to take part in.
Where do you see this struggle, the folks who are facing charges, Greenpeace facing the charges in organization, right? That's never happened before.
Right.
So where do you see, like, your role in all of this?
I see this as kind of almost holding a line against some sort of precedent being set on you know, civil liberties, and as well as holding a line on, you know, global warming.
The organization's attorney, David Halperin, accused Exxon of unconstitutionally targeting the group to silence its protest.
It is extremely vindictive and heavy-handed the way Exxon has come back against Greenpeace in this case, and it should concern anyone who believes that our tradition in this country of peaceful protest has actually enriched our political life and helped the country make smarter decisions.
At the same time this battle is fought in Texas, Greenpeace also faces federal charges brought by John Ashcroft's Department of Justice. Two Greenpeace activists intercepted a shipment of lumber illegally logged from the Amazon rainforest in Brazil as it entered a port on the Miami coast last year. Again, protesters expected to be punished for trespassing. Instead, they are being prosecuted under a federal law against sailor mongering. The statute has not been invoked for nearly 200 years, and it was originally designed to prevent brothel owners and their employees from boarding ships to entice sailors. Halperin says the protesters were exercising their free speech rights and that their prosecution signals a frightening trend.
And in fact, you know, a lot of ways it is like the Boston Tea Party. They climbed on a ship to object to the cargo on the ship. They were arrested, and again, they were willing to do their time if the crime had been committed here. But the government wanted more, and it wants to criminalize Greenpeace, and it is a radical change in the way the government looks at the issue of protest. They see it not as a positive part of our political tradition and history, but it's just another criminal act to be sort of taken up the chain of culpability and to bring down people who engage in it.
Greenpeace activists around the globe will be watching what happens in these trials with special interest in the Dallas case. If the Texas-born injunction stands, Exxon may be emboldened to fight Greenpeace internationally. Greenpeace UK's Emily Armistead, another one of the Irving 36, says she's not afraid of ExxonMobil and doesn't think the company's efforts will silence activists around the globe.
I mean, in the UK, although we don't have a Bill of Rights in the same way that you do, obviously, you know, our right to protest is still very important to us, and it's helped us shape our democracy as well. And although, I mean, yeah, I think that there's a reason to why both Exxon are acting in this heavy-handed way and the US government, and I think they are trying to frighten the environmental movement. But I don't think that it's going to work, you know. Greenpeace activists are... Since I've worked with Greenpeace, have just impressed me tremendously with their strength and with how principled they are. And they won't allow themselves to be bullied by companies like Exxon.
But back home in Texas, campaign coordinator John Hocevar said he's worried Exxon and the federal government's actions will have a chilling effect on political speech in America.
Well, there's a major protest coming up at Halliburton's shareholder meeting in Houston. And people have to be wondering, you know, is this going to happen to us? Are we going to be facing felony charges? Are we going to be getting sued by Halliburton for something that people have been doing for generations in this country and around the world? Is it now, you know, is the climate shifting so much that we're risking jail for speaking our minds? It's a scary time.
Don't push me. Call on close to the edge. I'm trying not to move my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. A child is born with no state of mind.
Take a stroke, it's the butchers and the big money makers. Drop big cars in the 20s and 10s and What's the problem? You the problem. That's right. You the problem.
Yo, you ain't got to
get in the car. Get in the car. Get in the car. I said, get in the car.
Why is he talking to us?
Are you a wise guy? Shut up.
If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I would tell you that the personal revolution is far more difficult than the first step in any revolution. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I would tell you that music is the expression of emotion, and that politics is merely the decoy of perception.
Defense, he did someone to save his life and he started to